Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Think Omnichannel podcast. This is the fourth episode, and the next few episodes are coming live from the Retail Bulletin's Omnichannel conference in London. I have come here to take part in a panel discussion and also to sit down with some of the industry's leading experts in the world of Omnichannel. So I've been delighted to have been joined by four separate guests, all talking about Omnichannel and what it means to them and the businesses they work for. So delighted to kick off the series with a fantastic session talking to Nick King from Auto Trader. So, absolutely delighted to be joined with my first guest today, Nick King. Nick works for Auto Trader, and Nick, you've just come off stage where you took part in a really insightful panel discussion about marketplaces. Obviously, the conference is an omni-channel conference, so it'd just be great just to introduce yourself. What do you do? Give us a bit of a potted history, because you've got an incredibly interesting background and job title.
Well, thanks, Graeme, and thanks for having me. And lovely to be here. And so I'm Nick. I'm Insight Director and Market Research Director at Auto Trader, and I'm a consumer psychologist. I study people. I'm fascinated by people, technology, and cars. So I've probably got one of the best jobs in the world, because I get a chance to talk about cars and people all day. I've been in marketing research for 35 years. I've been at Auto Trader for nearly 20, or working with them for 20. And Auto Trader is the largest marketplace in the UK. We have new and used cars. Predominantly, we started with used, but we now sell used cars too, or you can buy them if you can find them, because there's an issue at the moment with stock.
Yeah.
But it's, for us at Auto Trader, it is all about omnichannel. We've used that word, blended retailing, omnichannel, for a long, long, long time. People will talk about everything going online, solely online. Some sites still do manage to sell vehicles solely online. Some people will buy cars solely online. But for most people, what we think, and what our research tells us, is allow me to buy a car the way I want to buy a car. I might want to do a lot of my research online. I might want to sort out all my finance online, but I might still want to touch the car, to sit in the seats, to hold the steering wheel, to hear the clunk of the door, to go for a test drive. And you can't do that virtually. One of the reasons, when you look at virtual reality, why virtual reality hasn't taken off in all forms of commerce, is because you can't actually feel fear when you're driving a car with a virtual helmet on, because you have no G-forces. You can't actually feel that you might have a problem or you might have an issue. It's great for a virtual walk around, but actually for the physical sensation, the haptic challenge, that's something we talk about a lot. You can't get a haptic feeling virtually.
No.
So always worked in marketing research, apart from a long, long time ago. I was in one of the first indie bands in the UK, and I played a guitar, and I had a wall of Marshall amps here, and they've blown my ears away, and I'm stone deaf in my right ear, and my left ear has tinnitus. So if anyone who's listening to this podcast comes up to me and says hello, and I ignore you, I'm not being rude. Please shout it again.
Don't be shy. Tell us your band.
The bands. I was in a band called Great Northern Electrics. We were signed to Polydor. In 1990, we were on the same label as Blur, and we used to play with similar bands like that. We were quite big. We had a hit in America, got to number 6 in the Billboard dance charts, when Nirvana's Teen Spirit was at number 7. So we thought, Wow. Well, that's it, we've made it, and then we got dropped.
Oh.
Polydor, big record label, yeah, they are a bank who lends you money, and they want you to recoup that money very quickly. Normally, they'd give you a few years to do that. But in the 1990s, it was got to turn around in a year. And if you hadn't made it, you have failed. So we recorded an album. It was meant to, Q gave it 4 stars as a pre-release review. It's a great album. Still sounds good. But they never released it. So they dropped us and said, right, we've spent £250,000 on you. You don't owe us any money. But if you want the master tapes, you've got to buy them for £250,000.
Wow.
And this was 1990. £250,000 is a lot now, but it was like, blimey. So we said, well, forget it then. Very sad. We became a band called Echo Belly. It went on to be huge. I didn't join them because I couldn't bear getting back into a transit van and going up and down the M1 anymore. And I had the chance to join other big bands, potentially. didn't for various reasons, but did end up writing the music for Bird's Eye Chicken Dippers.
I apologise.
Not Bird's Eye Potato Waffles, they're waffle versatile. No, the really rubbish one, Bird's Eye Chicken Dippers, which is a treatment of a surf song. But in 1992, when you wrote an when you did the music, you got paid every time it was on. Amazing royalties. So it was like, wow, you don't anymore. You get a flat fee. But then it was really good money. So I blagged my way into advertising to do that because I used to work in advertising. I gave up my job to get in the band. So I phoned my friends who were creative directors and said, can I write the music for you? Because you've seen me on telly, you've heard me on the radio. And they went, oh, yeah, sure. But the music industry is it's almost like a mafia of six or seven writers who do all the music. And they said, who's this bloke who's just got one of our ads? So I was metaphorically stabbed in the back. So I didn't get any more ads. Then I thought I'd write music for comedy. So friends of mine are Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis. Hugh Dennis is on Mock the Week and Outnumbered. And Steve Punt's a brilliant writer from the Mary Whitehouse Experience. And they were doing a sitcom called Me, You and Him, a new sitcom, a bit like Men Behaving Badly. And I said, can I do the music for you? And he went, oh, well, have a go. So I wrote the music with a friend, gave it to the producer. He said, yeah, okay, you can do all the music for a program. I thought, Christ, I'm now a TV writer. And I'm in an episode, and I watched them being filmed, and it was brilliant, really funny, it was going to be successful, really good. And then the director and producer had a heart attack and died, and they cancelled it. So my music career went almost fail, almost fail, almost fail. And by then, I was 30, I thought, this is so hard to make it in music. I've got to go back to what I know, which is research, psychology, marketing. I got back into that. Ended up at a big agency, big media agency called, they're called Cara, Hugh Dentsu Aegis. They're now one of these monster media agencies, and I was research director there for a while. Autotrader was my client, and they said to me one day after 3 or 4 years, do you want to come and work for us? I went, oh, blimey, as new media business intelligence director. It's like, oh, what a title. This is 17 years ago when the internet was a small thing. Less money was being spent advertising on the internet than there was in cinema. Now, of course, it's dramatically massive. So I joined as an analyst, really, data analyst who can tell stories. And now what I do is my role is to go out and talk to retailers who advertise with us. We have 85% of all the retailers in the country advertising with us, and they spend a lot of money advertising on a premium product platform, which is what Autotrader is as a marketplace.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? And a big considered choice as well. Done on a marketplace, but what an amazing career story as well. Thanks for sharing that with us. It's incredible, and probably not what people were expecting to hear dialing into a omnichannel podcast. And on that point, we are here to talk about omnichannel, and this is obviously an omnichannel conference as well that we're sitting at. I ask everybody that comes on this podcast to define what their interpretation of the word omnichannel is. So I'd love to hear yours, given your experience. So in your words, give us what you think. Tell us what omnichannel is.
Great question, Graham. Right. What is omnichannel? Omnichannel, I think, and my personal view, which is probably the Autotrader view too, is allow me to buy a car the way I want to buy a car. Don't force me down one route. So I have to be available on whatever channel I am looking at. It could be my phone, it could be my laptop, it could be your physical store. Pure, true omnichannel for us is make that journey, it's not a journey actually, it's a series of jobs I have to do, as easy as possible, and allow me to do those jobs where I want to do my jobs. Some people will want to go and simply do everything online. Some people will not want to go online, want to do everything at the dealership. And that can take ages. Buying a car, buying a car is a complicated process because it's a lot of money, can be a lot of money, can be a huge amount of money, can be your life savings. And you're buying something which is going to depreciate. It's not going to appreciate unless you're really lucky. So if you can, what we actually discovered in some research was buying a car today is not a journey or a linear process or a funnel. It is a series of jobs you have to do, and they are more complicated and complex than you might have thought. How many jobs do you have to do to buy a car? Is it 4 or 5? Find the car, visit the retailer, test drive, sort the finance and buy it. 4 or 5. No, actually, there's more than about 30. And it's what type of car is it? What model? What shape? What colour? What description? How do you sort out finance? How do you understand jargon? How do you understand tax and insurance and warranties? And then how do you trust the retailer? And will the car fit on the drive? And would you look at reviews? And then you got to turn up and buy the car. And then you got to negotiate and prepare for haggling and sort it. And oh, this is just too many jobs.
I'm exhausted just listening to that.
It is, exactly. And I said that in a way because it is exhausting. It is exhausting. So in our research of 1,400 car buyers, so statistically robust sample of car buyers, what came out of this whole piece of research was a third said, if it was easier, I'd do it more often. Blimey. Wow. So if we can make car buying easier, and I use the word easy, not in an obvious way, then it's good for the whole industry. Because at the moment, there are pain points. No matter what age you are, there are pain points. Huge amount of pain points. Can I trust the reseller? Do I trust the advert? Is it actually going to be there when I buy it? Is the car actually for sale? One of the pain points that 18 to 24 year olds told us, so this is a proper demographic segment, was I can't see the availability of the car I want, but the car's advertised. But you've got to tell me it's there. Drive away, really obvious stuff. None of it's rocket science, but yeah, so I'm buying something that I'm scared of buying because it's really expensive. Am I going to drive 50 miles to find something to find, oh, it's not actually there? Tell me it's there in your advert, really easy. That is omnichannel. When you're helping me buy my product, the car, helping me tick off a lot of those jobs so that however I want to buy it, I can buy it. And I might want to buy it online completely, or I might want to do half and half.
Yeah, and that's really interesting. What is the split between customers that actually end up buying the car online and end up buying the car physically in one of those garages, retailers?
That's a really good question. And there's a couple of well-known brands, Cazoo and Cinch, for example. And Cazoo are really big customers of ours. Cinch aren't, because they're owned by British Car Auctions, who are competitors, effectively. They also own WeBuyAnyCar.com. So there's a bit of a Cinch, obviously, great company. But the issue with WeBuyAnyCar.com is you will put your details in to get a valuation for your car on the WeBuyAnyCar.com site. And then you'll be told to go to an Asda car park where there's a shed and a guy sat there or girl sat there who will then value your car and give you the money. And they are commissioned not to give you what you were offered. They get a percentage of what they make. Less. So if the site says we're going to give you £20,000 for the car and they walk around it with you and say, well, actually point out all the faults, they're actually only going to give you 19, they get 30% of that. So they get 300 wow. quid, which isn't very transparent, is it?
No.
But if you've described your car beautifully and accurately, then they won't find fault, but they will go through it with a fine tooth comb and find fault. The good cars then go to Cinch and are advertised, and the poorer cars go to auctions where everyone else has to buy them. I'm sorry, I'm going a bit off track here, but it is a bit, that's not a very great experience for some people. It's good, their adverts are great, the music, the tune, WeBuyAnyCar.com, everyone talks about it. It's like McDonald's, you know the whistling tune, you know it, it's a good bit of brand awareness. But they haven't really, really nailed success in online only, because both Cinch and Cazoo will allow you to return a car, but it's a bit of a hassle returning a car. It is, despite the fact that it doesn't matter, return the car. You can buy the car. Doesn't matter. If you don't like it, send it back. Really? You've gone through all the hassle of the paperwork and doing all the numbers and sorting out the finance, and you've part exchanged your existing car. And, hang on a minute. I don't like the car. I want to send it back. What if you want to do it twice? They won't let you do it twice. What if you do it three times? Many people. So to answer your question, what's the percentage? It's almost impossible to give it a split, but we still see a lot of people coming onto forecourts to actually do the transaction. They might want to sort their finance out, but they still actually turn up at the physical forecourt to drive the car, just to sit in it, to hear the clunk of the door, feel the steering wheel. All cars are good now. You can't buy a bad car now. They're all good. They're all well made. The gaze of the terrible, terrible old Skodas and Wolfs and Wartburgs from the 1970s where they rusted, they don't exist. Those don't exist. Cars are good now. Larders, they don't exist anymore. All cars are good, but they might not suit you.
Yeah, it's a definite choice thing, isn't it? It's your personal choice in terms of you have to sit in it and experience it. And it's a big thing, to your point there, it's a big thing to return. You know, it's not like
a pair of shoes. No. Or I was talking to one of the other attendees here who's a They're from Pour Moi, which is lingerie. Now, I don't buy lingerie. Surprise, surprise. My wife buys it, but I don't buy it. But, and I said to him, what's your returns policy? How many returns do you get? And he said 40%. 40%? And that is bad. So people will buy three different sizes and send three of them back, two of them back. Keep one, send two back. That can't be a great business model, really.
No.
Talk about wastage and expense and all of those things. So with a car, do you really want to send it back? Actually, what we do here is all retailers could offer online transaction, but you have a thing called distance selling rules. And actually, that 7-day return policy, 14-day return policy is the least they should do. You've actually got almost 6 months. If the car's in the same condition with hardly any mileage, you can return it up to 6 months. And which retailer wants a car coming back at 5 months, 4 weeks, 3 weeks old later? No one wants that.
No, exactly. Well, so it sounds like what you're doing is you're giving a range of businesses across the country the opportunity to become an omnichannel retailer through your platform. And it's funny because Auto Trader, there won't be many people listen to this that haven't heard of Auto Trader. It's a household brand. It's been around forever from magazines, 45 years, magazines all the way through now into the online platform. That must have been, I don't know if you, were you in the business when you transitioned more from magazine to digital platform?
Yeah.
And tell us about that journey, because that, you know, the moving from a physical to digital is something that a lot of brands struggle with, especially making it omnichannel and trying not to create just a brand new channel that replaces an existing channel. It's, you know, trying to get the art of connecting all the existing assets together to create a seamless experience is the kind of art of the omnichannel transformation element of it. But you've obviously done that through creating probably one of the UK's biggest marketplaces, certainly the biggest from a car perspective, but doing so without people really realizing it's a marketplace, really, right? You know, when you say marketplace, people immediately think Amazon, et cetera.
Yeah. We are. Great question. And yes, so I'm lucky enough to have gone through that. So when I joined Auto Trader, we are the third biggest circulating magazine in the UK. TV Times, Radio Times, Auto Trader. We used to sell 440,000 copies a week. We had 13 regional editions. So we had 13 head offices. There was Thames Valley Trader, there was Scottish Trader, there's one in Scotland, there's one in Manchester. We had 13 regional editions. They came out every Thursday, and they were huge selling. So every Thursday, you'd buy a copy of the Auto Trader in Smith's or in Menzies or wherever it was, and 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning, you'd start. The savvy dealers would start finding the cars, and then they'd sell. But that magazine would last till the following Wednesday. So you buy a copy of Auto Trader on Wednesday, there's no point because all the good cars are gone. At the same time, we had this small fledgling website, like everyone did at the beginning. When I joined, we had a tiny little website with, it was 90-10. 90% of our activity was magazine, 10% was the website. And I joined to help, try and help build the website 16 years ago. By 2013, magazine sales had declined so much and the website had grown so much that we decided to stop printing. We stopped printing a magazine finally in 2014. So 7-8 years ago, and people still come for interviews and say, oh, I saw the magazine in Smith's, because it's got such a brand awareness. In fact, if you go around most news agents in the UK, you'll still see a little sticker for Auto Trader in the window or on the bins where the papers are. I've got pictures in my local one. It's still there. And what that does for a brand is create brilliant brand awareness, because you keep hearing it, you keep saying it, it keeps in your mind. So we had to lose 13 regional offices. We had Printworks. We owned Printworks. We had huge print. We had 4,000 employees. We had people who go out with a Polaroid camera and take a photo of a car and come back and physically load it into the paper to be printed on Thursday or Wednesday night, go out on Thursdays. We had to, unfortunately, lose those people, shrink the business, and just concentrate online, because clearly in a classified world, which is what we were, a classified site, things sell quickly. If something sold quickly, you can remove it and put and use that space to sell something else, rather than keep a blank space in a newspaper for a week. We did have trouble though trying to persuade retailers to put their pictures on the No one likes change. All these retailers who were used to the magazine, because at the same time we had Exchange and Mart and Loot and these other magazines which were classifieds, which worked because that was how you sold vehicles. We used to have two sales teams. the digital sales team and the magazine sales team, and they go and see the same customer and try and get them to spend money on both sites or on the magazine. And it was almost cannibalizing each other. It was ridiculous. Until it became so clear that the website had taken off. And actually, one of the drivers of the website was Wi-Fi. Before Wi-Fi, when we had plugged in cables and people had PCs, it was a sort of, see, the PC was in the back bedroom in a spare room, and that's, you didn't watch telly. You went out and looked on the PC, you logged in through your dial-up modem and you looked at things, then you went back and watched telly. When the Wi-Fi modem appears, when wireless Wi-Fi appears and we get smartphones, you think, oh, actually, I can do this anywhere. I can sit on the bog and look at a car. And people started to, and our traffic started to grow. And now, of course, without jumping straight ahead, most of our traffic is on smartphones now. That's where most of our traffic is. You can you don't have to make an appointment to go and turn on the modem and sit in the back room and search with your mouse. You can do it anywhere, on the bus, on the tram, in the bath, in bed, on the loo. Like, we do get a huge number of people doing it. It's revolting, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, it's, you don't take a book in or a paper if you're a bloke. You take your phone in, because you can, and it's quick. So the dramatic change is we have become a digital company. We are now a digital data company. That's what we are. We're a tech company. We're a FTSE 100 PLC. And we try to hire people, the similar type of brainy Java programming people that would work at Facebook or Spotify or Twitter or Amazon. We try and hire them. So we have 1,000 employees. We used to have 4,000. We've now got 1,000 employees. And our head office is Manchester, because it's a tech center, but we have beautiful offices that are like Google. If you go around Google, they've got restaurants and slides and games, and it's really cool and it's funky. You can write on the walls. We've got all that too, but except we have cars in our office. You can sit in and have a meeting. You can have a meeting in a Jag or an Alfa or a TVR or a, what's the other one we've got? An Audi Quattro. Oh, yeah, from the 80s. Wow. The actual car. You can sit in a car and have a meeting. So we make them a funky place, so people don't want to come and work at Facebook or Google. They want to come and work for us.
That's amazing.
So we get great people.
Well, we'll maybe do a follow-up podcast, and we can do it in a Jag or something.
Do it. Come to us.
Yeah, okay. I'll take you up on that. That's brilliant. So just sort of finally wrapping up, because I know you've got to shoot off to another conference to talk to more people about what you've talked to us about today. But sort of wrapping up, have you got any advice for people in terms of, you know, those that are either in an existing business trying to implement an omnichannel transformation, or a new business trying to start from scratch with an omnichannel offering? Any kind of top tips that you would sort of profess to people in terms of a strategy or an approach?
Great question. So there's a few things, but it boils down to, here are the four key tenets we've worked out which apply to anything in retail, certainly in omnichannel, and it is, and I did say it earlier, apologies, Graham, you heard me say it before, but it is simple, easy, quick, and transparent. Now that sounds like a facetious thing to say, but it isn't easy to make things, inverted commas, easy. But you need to think, in our world today, we as human beings have a brain, and our brain is split into two parts, your primal and your rational brain. Primal brain's much older in evolutionary terms, and it reacts to basic stimuli, sight, sound, noise, and it keeps us alive. It kept us alive in Neanderthal times. It would spot a danger and it would react to it. Rational brain's a lot younger in evolutionary terms, and we use it to create spreadsheets, build a product, and it's tiring to use it. Human beings are fundamentally lazy, not in a horrible way, but we like things to be easy, and primal brain keeps it easy. If something's difficult, it gets in the way. So if you can make your site, break down any barriers, so whatever you're building, there are no barriers. It is simple, it is easy, it is quick, and if it's transparent, it builds trust. An example of this, and I hate to use Amazon, but I'm going to use Amazon, is that they are that. You want to buy anything on Amazon today, I use it all the time because it is easy, simple, quick, and transparent. I even have one swipe. I find the product, I swipe it once on my phone, and it's bought, and it's arriving the next day. Beautiful. And if you're not happy with it, you can send it back. And more often than not, they'll say, don't bother sending it back. We'll send you another one. That is trusted transparency. And of course, what they do as well is they recommend things, that beautiful recommendation engine. Other people who saw this, bought this, also bought this. How many times have you, if you're honest, not thought, oh, that looks quite good?
Yeah.
The best recommendation engine I've ever seen is Netflix. We have two Netflix accounts. I have one, my wife has one, for our kids. And I'll log in. If I log in as Nick and I look at Top Gun, the latest Top Gun film, it will show me a picture of Tom Cruise whizzing through the skies because I like action films. It knows that. But if my wife logs in as Carolyn and she looks at Top Gun, the picture will be Tom Cruise bursting into tears because she likes depressing programs. That's brilliant behavioural targeting.
I did not know that.
You'd be amazed. There was a great example of that in the football last year, the World Cup. They had live advertising going round the pitches when you were watching the game. You could see the advertising moving. And I've got an image at home of four different screens. One's Germany, one's Italy, one's us, and one's... And it's the same programme, the same time, the same pitch, and all the adverts are different.
Wow.
Depending on where you're sat. That is an omnichannel approach.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Hugely insightful. I've really enjoyed chatting to you, listening to you on the panel and also chatting to you today. So thank you, Nick.
Great. Thanks, Graham. Lovely to see you.
So there are three more fantastic sessions to tune into. So if you're liking what you're hearing, please follow this podcast on your desired podcast platform. Give us a review if you would like as well, and you'll be notified when the next episode is being published. So thanks very much indeed for listening. Thanks to Nick for all his brilliant insights. Hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you on the next episode.